Good morning. Great to see all of you. My name is John Mark. I'm not really into chit-chat. Please turn in your Bibles to the Gospel of Mark, chapter 8. I repeat, the Gospel of Mark, chapter 8. If you're new or visiting, welcome. Great to see all of you on this Portland fall day. We're in a series through the Gospel of Mark, kind of one chapter at a time, one paragraph at a time, one sentence at a time. This week is Mark 8, 1 to 21. Let's pray really fast. That's right. Jesus, we invite you by your Spirit to right now come and speak. Unstop the deaf, illuminate the blind. Speak in a healing, powerful, cutting, prophetic voice, I pray. Amen. Okay, we left off last week with Jesus on the east side of the Sea of Galilee in a region called the Decapolis. He's outside of Israel, and he's deep into pagan, so to speak, territory. And that is the backdrop for this next passage. With that in mind, let's work through it one sentence at a time. Mark chapter 8, verse 1. During those days, or right at that time, another large crowd gathered. Since they had nothing to eat, Jesus called his disciples to him and said, "I have compassion for these people. They have already been with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. If I send them home hungry, they will collapse on the way because some of them have come from a long distance." People are coming from all over the Decapolis, which is this region of 10 cities. I mean, all over the place by the thousands, hungry and thirsty for Jesus' teaching, to listen to this young, brilliant, provocative rabbi from Nazareth. They are hanging on his every word for days at a time with no food, to the point that it's dangerous, right? The disciples are scared that, hey, if we send people away right now, if we send people home, there's a good chance people will collapse, people will faint, people will starve to death on the way home. And Jesus is filled, we read, with compassion. The word compassion in Greek, the original language of the New Testament, is splagnon, and it's actually a word for a piece of your anatomy, your digestive tract, or your vital organs. It's kind of how we would say gut-wrenching. It's a way of saying, it's a figure of speech, that Jesus was moved from the inside out, from his splagnon, right? And I was teaching this story, actually, to the kids of my missional community as a warm-up for this weekend. And every Wednesday night, we get together, we share a meal. After dinner, we circle up the kids in the living room. And one of the guys in my community is a designer for Adidas. And so we get out an easel, and he draws everything, and the kids ignore me and watch the drawing. But whatever. So I was teaching this passage, and I get to this part where Jesus was filled with compassion. I said, "Hey, kids, have you ever felt so much love, looked at somebody, and felt so much love in your heart for that person?" And Jude, my 8-year-old, goes, "Daddy, the new neighbor girl, Riley." First time I saw her, I totally had a crush on her. Not exactly what I was going for, right? That's kind of the idea, sort of. When Jesus looked at the crowd, he was filled with compassion in his splagnon, right? Deep down inside Jesus' gut, he was moved. And keep reading. His disciples answered, "But where in this remote place," so that can be translated wilderness, "can anyone get enough bread to feed him?" We're out in the middle of nowhere. There's no grocery store. There's no Whole Foods or New Seasons. Seriously, we're out in the middle of nowhere. "How many loaves do you have?" Jesus asked. "Well, 7, they replied. He told the crowd to sit down on the ground. When he had taken the 7 loaves and given thanks, he broke them and gave them to his disciples to distribute. "Hey, you guys pass out and give to the people." And they did so. They had a few small fish as well. He gave thanks for them also and told the disciples to distribute or pass out them. The people ate and were satisfied. Afterwards, the disciples picked up 7 basketfuls of broken pieces that were left over. About 4,000 were present. Now, how many of you are feeling deja vu right now? If you've been around for the last few months in Mark, maybe or maybe not, you're thinking, wait a minute, didn't we already read this story? Didn't we already read about Jesus feeding thousands of people out in the wilderness? And what's the answer? Yes. This is actually the second story in Mark about Jesus feeding thousands of people out in the middle of nowhere, and it's very similar. It's in a, quote, remote place or in the wilderness with people coming by the droves from all over, listening to Jesus teach, really hanging on Jesus' every word. They get hungry. They get thirsty. Jesus is filled with compassion. That exact same word is used twice, and there's a few scraps of bread and fish, and so Jesus gave thanks. He worked a miracle, and the disciples passed it out, and there was so much food that it was left over at the end. Very similar, but one thing is very different. The first time, Jesus was feeding Jews in Israel. This time around, Jesus is feeding Gentiles, which is a way of saying non-Jewish people, like the majority of you here, myself included, feeding Gentiles in the Decapolis, in pagan world. That's why there are seven loaves at the beginning and then seven baskets that are left over. Seven was a symbolic number in the ancient world for the Gentiles. This part of the world was called the Land of the Seven because there were seven Gentile nations. Think of the Old Testament. You read about Canaan and the Canaanites and the Perizzites and the Hittites, all that, the Land of the Seven. So this is a symbolic number. Mark's point is that Jesus isn't just the Messiah for Israel. He's also the Messiah, that's a Jewish way of saying the King or the coming Savior, for the whole world. Meaning Jesus' salvation, his life, his healing, his teaching, his touch, his power, all that he is and all that he stands for, it's not just for Israel, not just for first century Jews. It's also for Greeks and Romans in the first century and the 21st. It's also for Chinese and Indians and Canadians. Let's throw them in too. And Americans, right? Tim, that was for you. It's for the whole world, and it's beautiful. But what happens next is a bit of a twist. Keep reading. After he had sent them away, he got into the boat with his disciples and went to the region of Dalmanutha, which is on the west end of the lake. So now he's back in Israel. The Pharisees, a Jewish religious sect, came and began to question Jesus. That word came in Greek is actually a military verbiage. It's used of when an army would come out to fight or come out to war with another army or nation. And that word question can be translated argue or bicker or dispute or interrogate or challenge. That's the idea behind it. The Pharisees are basically at war with Jesus. To test him, they asked him for a sign from heaven, which is a bit ridiculous in my opinion. I mean, Jesus just finished feeding thousands of people with a grocery bag for the second time. And here are the Pharisees. Yeah, I'm not sure if I buy it. I don't know. And notice, they're not just asking for a sign. They're asking for a particular kind of sign, for a sign from heaven. They don't believe that Jesus is from God. They don't believe he's the Messiah, much less the, quote, Son of God, unquote. And they demand evidence, but it's evidence based on their criteria for who the Messiah is or isn't, and on their terms. One scholar writes this, a guy by the name of Beilzekhan, which is just awesome. If you're his daughter, you're just waiting for marriage. No offense if that's your last name. Moving on. The kind of Messiah they want will never come. They are determined to find a compliant Superman who is endowed with heavenly powers and will fulfill their earthly program, the Messiah of their dreams. Yeah, good thing we are nothing like the Pharisees at all. And Jesus does not bend, not at all. Keep reading. He sighed deeply. Meaning that's a vivid language in Greek. He's torn up, he's angry, he's mad, he's sad, he's hurt, despair, dismay. He sighed deeply and said, "Why does this generation ask for a sign? Truly I tell you," and that's emphatic language, "no sign will be given it." Then he left them, got back in the boat, crossed to the other side. I mean, right then, not only does he say no, but no, turn around, walk out the door, I'm gone. Emphatic, really interesting. Now, there are two layers to this part of the story. At one level, the Pharisees represent the heart posture of unbelief. Keep in mind that there's a difference between doubt and unbelief. Here's what I mean. Doubt is the search for truth. It's when you're not sure if something is truth or a lie. Is it real or is it a charade? But at its essence, at its core, doubt is a struggle to believe. Unbelief, on the other hand, is an obstinate, arrogant, stubborn, what Jesus called hard-heartedness against God, against faith. It's a way of thinking that demands that God come to you on your terms. And this heart posture is all over the place in the world that we call home. You see it in people who reject God because he doesn't fit the stereotype of who they think he should be. Not long ago, I heard somebody say, "I'm not sure I can believe in a God who would judge people." And while I get the gravity of the coming judgment and the tension between God's justice and God's mercy, I get that. I am well aware. I struggle with you. But think about the logic of that statement. I'm not sure I can believe in a God who would judge people. Like, doesn't matter what you believe. He is or he isn't. And what if I said, I'm not sure if I can believe in a scientific law that said E equals MC squared. I don't know. Like, who cares what you think? I mean, it is or it isn't. In the same way, we have this attitude that is alive and well, and not only in culture at large, but sadly in the church in a twisted way. So at one level, they represent the heart posture of unbelief, but another level, they represent Israel in the wilderness. If you know that story from the second book in the Bible, it's called Exodus. This paragraph right here, 11 to 13, is loaded with language from Exodus. The word test, for example, is used all over Exodus for when Israel would test God out in the desert. Can God really supply food? Can God really supply water? That word generation is a signpost of a word. It's used all over Exodus and all over the Old Testament as a whole for the generation that died off in the wilderness because of unbelief. And then that word sign is used all over Exodus for God's work in the 10 plagues, if you know that story or that movie, either way, and the Red Sea and manna and water from the rock, miracle after miracle, or in the language of Exodus, sign after sign. If you were a first century Jew and you were reading Mark by yourself or out loud at church, you would pick up on all of the allusion and all of the resonance with the Exodus story. Mark is saying that the Pharisees are kind of like Israel in the desert. Now, this is stunning in context. If you think back to last week, the story or two right before this one is about Jesus up in Tyre and Sidon, up in pagan territory in the north with a Syrophoenician woman with a demon-possessed daughter. Okay, Syrophoenician, she's Gentile in a racist culture. She's a female in a sexist culture with a demon-possessed daughter, meaning she's a pagan through and through. And not only that, but she's steeped in paganism. And she has way more faith in Jesus than the Pharisees, who are the epitome of quote-unquote Jewish faith. The irony in Mark's writing is thick. But this isn't just a story about the Pharisees. To be honest, this is a story about you and me. Keep reading. 14. The disciples had forgotten to bring bread, except for one loaf they had with them in the boat. Seriously. I mean, you think if you had 7 baskets of miracle bread in the pantry, you wouldn't forget it when you go out. You know, I mean, seriously, how dumb. Good thing we are so much smarter than they are. But to Jesus, that's a teaching opportunity. Be careful, Jesus warned to them. Watch out for the yeast of the Pharisees and that of Herod. Oh, that is classic Rabbi Jesus. Cryptic, like enigmatic, his little riddle from time to time. You ever read Jesus and you're like, I have no idea what you're saying. That's kind of sort of on purpose. It's to make you think, to make you ponder, to make you, what, really? And here is Jesus warning the disciples against the yeast, or a better translation of that is the leaven of the Pharisees and that of Herod. Now, leaven in the ancient world was made by keeping back part of the dough for about a week, and it would ferment, kind of like sourdough, and you would use it as a homemade rising agent for the next batch. But it was dangerous because it was easy for it to go bad and infect, if not ruin, the next batch. And because of that, leaven in the ancient world was symbolic for evil. It's subtle, but it's corrupting and poisonous, and in the end, it's lethal. Jesus is warning the disciples against the subtle but corrupting heart posture of the Pharisees and that of Herod, which begs the question, what is the leaven or the heart posture of the Pharisees and Herod? And it's a bit tricky since the Pharisees and Herod had little or nothing in common. They were at the exact opposite end of the spectrum in culture at large. The Pharisees were a right-wing, ultra-religious, nationalistic sect. Herod, on the other hand, was a leftist, irreligious, sellout to Rome of a king. They had little or nothing in common. The one point of convergence between Herod and the Pharisees was unbelief. They did not believe that Jesus was from God. They did not believe he was the Messiah. They did not believe he was the Son. And on top of that, they were actually against Jesus. They were in opposition. They were antagonistic. They were at war, so to speak, with Jesus. That is the one common denominator. Now, Jesus, interesting, said to his disciples who did believe that he was from God, who did believe, come back next week for the story, that he was the Messiah, and who were not against Jesus, who were not in opposition to Jesus, but were his disciples or his followers, he said to his disciples, hey, watch out. Be careful. Watch out for the leaven of the Pharisees and that of Herod. Now, why would he say that? Well, keep reading. 16. They discussed this with one another and said, it's because we have no bread. If you ever want to feel better about yourself, read about the disciples. I mean, seriously, it's a metaphor. You are an idiot, right? All 12 of you, it's a metaphor. How obtuse are you, right? They don't get it. Aware of their discussion, Jesus asked them, why are you talking about having no bread? Do you still not see or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Do you have eyes but fail to see and ears but fail to hear? Don't you remember when I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000? How many basketfuls of pieces did you pick up? 12, they replied. And when I broke the 7 loaves for the 4,000, how many basketfuls of pieces did you pick up? I just imagine crickets right there. 7, they answered. He said to them, do you still not understand? You still not get it. Are you that blind? Are you that deaf? Are you that stupid? He doesn't say that, but you know, it's the interpretation. Are you still don't get it? Now, in that barrage of interesting 7 questions, in that, there's a quote of a well-known line that's used in the Exodus and all through what we call the Old Testament, or what is better called the Hebrew Scriptures. And it's a line that's used for Israel in the wilderness, for the generation that died off because of unbelief, and for how that heart posture, that attitude was alive and well down through Israel's history. And it's the line, do you have eyes but fail to see and ears but fail to hear? For example, here's the prophet Jeremiah. This is one of many. Announce this to the descendants of Jacob. Proclaim it to Judah. It's a way of saying all Israel. Hear this, you foolish and senseless people. You who have eyes but do not what?
See.
Who have ears but do not what? Should you not fear me, declares the Lord? Should you not tremble in my presence? I made the sand a boundary for the sea, an everlasting barrier it cannot cross. The waves may roll, and this is symbolic for anarchy and evil and chaos in your life, but they cannot prevail. They may roar, but they cannot cross it. But these people have stubborn and rebellious what? Hearts. They've turned aside and gone away. They do not say to themselves, let us fear the Lord our God, who gives autumn and spring rains and season, who assures us of the regular weeks of harvest. That's one of many, example after example, this idea of eyes but fail to see, ears but fail to hear. Jesus is saying, listen, Peter, James, John, guys, you are like Israel in the wilderness. Not just the Pharisees. You are. Miracle after miracle, but you still don't believe. I just finished feeding thousands of people with a few scraps of bread and a fish or two for the second time, and you are worried about lunch for 13. You still don't trust me. After all that we have been through together, after all of my faithfulness, you still don't trust me. The exact same, and here's the killer, the exact same heart posture that's in the Pharisees is in you. Jesus is frustrated. He's upset. He's, I think, a bit angry. But it's not because Jesus is a jerk or he's mean or he's rude. I would argue it's because what the disciples are missing is vital. It's crucial. You have to wrap your head around it. And it's not only vital for Peter and James and the 12, it's also vital for you and me as disciples of Jesus. When we worry about the stuff of life, about bread, we have no bread. Food in the cupboard, money to pay the bills, rent, the house, this, that, the other, your job, your lack thereof, the past, the future, the mistakes in your wake, whatever it is, when we worry, when we don't trust God, when we don't trust Jesus' love, the fact that you're loved, all of you're loved. Jesus' power, the tomb is empty. Anything, that resurrection creative energy is pulsing through you. And Jesus' presence, the fact that he is with you 24/7, whether you're with him or not. When we don't trust in that kind of a God and we still worry, it's leaven. It's leaven. It's the exact same subtle but corrupting, in the end, lethal heart posture of the Pharisees and Herod. Now, I'm not going to lie. To me, that is somewhere between incredulous and a bit offensive. What do you mean I'm like the Pharisees? The Pharisees didn't believe in you. I do. The Pharisees were against you. I'm not against you. I mean, seriously, I follow you. I live out your way. I mean, but Jesus' point is that it's the exact, if you trace it to the source, it's the exact same heart posture. The same attitude that says, show me a sign from heaven and I'll believe, is the one that says, we have no bread. I don't know if I believe. At its root, if you trace it to the leaven, to the source, it's exactly the same. It's unbelief. Now, a few thoughts. This is a rebuke, but it's about the most encouraging rebuke I've ever read, all right? A few thoughts on the leaven of the Pharisees and Herod versus the bread, so to speak, of Jesus. Five things if you're taking notes. First off, it's a heart posture, a blindness not seen. Jesus in 18 said, "Do you have eyes but fail to see?" So often, I am blind. I don't see God's work in my life. The signs, so to speak, of God's, or the evidence of God's love and power and presence are all over the place and all around my life. I'm swimming in God's world, but I'm blind. I'm oblivious. I'm numb. I'm indifferent. I'm distracted. I'm out of tune. I'm out of touch. And in fact, all I see are the dark spots. All I see are the spots in my life where it's unclear, where it's fuzzy, where it's scary, where it's nerve-wracking, where I don't see God's love, where I don't see God's power, where I don't see God's presence. That's what I see. That's what is consuming my thought life and my imagination. As a result, I'm scared and I'm nervous. We have no bread. I wonder if it's because, and maybe this is just me, but that I look for God in the miraculous, but not in the mundane. And God is in the miraculous, in the Red Sea, so to speak, in the feeding of thousands of people. He's in that, absolutely. But I would argue at the same time, the miraculous is in the mundane. In the gift of oxygen for a brand new day, in the food on your table, in the laughter of a child. God's in that. His love, his power, his presence in your life are all over that. It's fascinating to me that Jesus' miracles with bread and fish, which was the staple diet around first century Galilee, I mean, if you have the power to feed thousands of people with one grocery bag, you think what Jesus would serve up a gourmet, delicious, culinary masterpiece, right? But it's not. It's not Pock Pock or Portland City Grill. It's bread and fish. It's miraculous, but it's miraculous in the mundane. Listen, my friends, if you follow Jesus, and maybe even if you don't, the fingerprints of God are all over your life. This coming week, may you see. May you open up your eyes and look for God and look for God's work in your life. Trust me, it's there. And may you see God in the miraculous and in the mundane. Secondly, it's a heart posture of deafness, not hearing. Jesus goes on to say in the second half of 18, eyes but fail to see, and do you have ears but fail to what? Hear. So often I'm deaf to God's voice. I don't hear God. And it's not because God is silent, but it's because God is quiet and life is noisy, and I don't know how to hear. Life is noisy and obnoxious and loud. We live in the modern world in a metropolitan city, 24/7, traffic, the commute, technology, your iPhone is with you, Twitter, Instagram, your CNN app, whatever it is, MP3 player, headphones on your ears, noise, 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 go, go, go. And that's not all bad, but it is if somehow in the midst of all that we don't hear God's voice. We need to relearn the art, and it is an art, of silence and solitude. Whether you're introverted or extroverted, either way, you're made to know God. We need to relearn how to get away, how to get out from underneath the wall of sound, how to unplug, how to power down, how to go on a walk, how to maximize this thing we have called the park, how to get outside, how to listen, how to get up early, how to carve out space in our home, our apartment, just to hear, just to get, just to breathe, just to be. Remember that God's voice is usually a whisper. He's a soft-spoken God. Why? I'm not sure. Here's my guess, and I may be off. My guess is because God is after intimacy with his children. And when you're soft-spoken, you have to get alone to hear. You know, imagine if there's a party at your house or Christmas is coming up. You're ready for that? Imagine you had a Christmas party in a couple of weeks and it's crazy and noisy and loud fun, but there's noise all over the place. If there's somebody there and you really want to connect with that person and engage past small talk, you want to get down to the soul, the odds are you'll say, hey, let's step outside real fast and go on a walk. Hey, let's step into the back room and chat. Hey, let's step over into a corner and sit down in order to hear. I wonder if that's what God's voice is like. We're in the middle of this crazy, noisy, obnoxious, crowded life. And I wonder if God's just saying, John Mark, I want to talk to you. What? Come here, I want to talk to you. I can't hear you. That's the point. I want to talk to you. But what? And so we have to step away and we have to step outside the door and we have to pull into the corner just to hear. This coming week, carve out time. However you're wired, however you're set up, maybe it's a walk, maybe it's early in the morning, maybe it's late at night, maybe it means you go to the coast for a day or an afternoon. I have no clue, but carve out time to hear. Don't live your life deaf to God's voice, but hear God speaking to you all the time. Third, if you're taking notes, it's a heart posture of forgetting and not remembering. Right after that, in 18, Jesus said, don't you remember when I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000, how many basketfuls of pieces did you pick up? 12, they replied. Interesting. It was in Israel, symbolic for the 12 what? Tribes. And when I broke 7 loaves for the 4,000, how many basketfuls of pieces did you pick up? They answered, 7 for the land of the 7 or for the Gentiles. Jesus saying, listen, I have come through for you time after time after time in just the right way. 12 for Israel, 7 for the Gentiles. That was brilliant. I mean, come on, give me a little bit of credit. So often, I forget God's faithfulness in my life. I just reread my journal from last year. I have a Moleskine journal. It's a Christian white guy thing. I just reread my journal last week, and it was stunning to me how much I had forgotten, how much that God had said to me, prophecy after prophecy, word after word, how much God had done. Oh my God, I forgot God did that. God did that. How many prayers God had answered. I keep a prayer journal. Basically, my journal is basically prayers and prophetic stuff. And I keep this journal. I'm going back. Yeah, God answered that prayer. God answered that prayer. God answered that prayer. Still waiting on that one, but God answered this prayer. God answered that one. Different, but better. And I mean, time, but I had forgotten. It's basically God amnesia, so to speak. This coming week, may you remember, don't forget, but may you remember God's faithfulness in your past, and may that memory enable you to trust God in your present and in your future. Fourth, if you're taking notes, it's a heart posture of questioning, not asking. In 11, if you circle back to that, the Pharisees came and began to question. Remember, that can be translated interrogate Jesus. There's a difference between questions and questioning. By questions, I mean raw, uncut, honest questions or doubts that at its root are a search for truth. And God is not afraid of your questions, and neither are we as a church. God is not afraid of your doubts. It's okay. And there's a line in the New Testament, a command that flat out says, be merciful to those who doubt. If you doubt, you're not going to get kicked out or not going to look down on you. No, like God says, be merciful to those who doubt. Doubt is a search for truth. And God's door is wide open to questions. But there's a difference between that and questioning. Meaning when you come to God and you demand God meet you on your terms, when you demand, or we would call it prayer, right? But that God do what we want, when we want it, and how we want it. And sadly, that might pass for American Christianity right now with the depth of consumerism that we have. But that is not the way of Jesus. This coming week, instead of questioning, God, I demand, show me a sign from heaven. Instead of that, the way of Jesus is questions and ask. Instead of that, ask God in prayer. It's okay to ask. God, here's my heart. Here's what I'm feeling. Here's the weight I'm under. Here's my fear. Here's my anxiety over the future. God, would you do this? God, would you do that? Please, in humility and dependence and honesty, come to God, not questioning, but asking. And then last, if you're taking notes, it's a heart posture of entitlement, not gratitude. Entitlement says, I deserve better. You owe me. Give it up now. Gratitude says, seriously? Me? Are you kidding? I don't deserve this. I don't deserve that. Thank you. And here, how can I share? How can I distribute it? How can I pass it out and eat and enjoy? And entitlement is latent in the American worldview. We grow up in a cultural milieu that whispers in our ears, as children, you deserve this. Like, parents never say that to your children. Feel free to say the reciprocal. You do not deserve this. That's great. But we grow up literally, you deserve this, you deserve this, you deserve this. Or worse yet, you deserve better. Oh, yeah, you deserve better. Oh, that's how they treat you. You deserve better. That is entitlement through and through. Look at Jesus to compare and contrast. In 6, when he had taken the 7 loaves, which is not much at all, like that's not great, and given thanks, he broke them. This is ahead of the miracle. And gave them to his disciples to distribute to the people. They did so. Then they had a few small fish as well. He gave thanks for them also, for a few small fish. I mean, if I was Jesus, I would be saying, God, seriously, there are thousands of people here. All I have is a few small fish. I deserve better. I'm the Messiah. I'm the Son of God. But instead, it's God, thank a few small fish? Really? Thank you. Stale bread? God, thank you. Like, and I think it's an honesty. He gave thanks. What if that was the template for our life? What if we were to take the bread and the fish that's in front of us, take the life that's spread out before you, and give thanks, not grumble or bicker or complain, but God, thank you. And then pass it out. Share. Hey, how can I help him? How can I help her and my family? And then eat. Enjoy. Celebrate God's world. What if that was the template for how we are to live as followers of Jesus? What if we were to take the marriage that's spread out before us? Give thanks. Pass it out and eat. What if we were to take the family that's set before us? Give thanks, pass it out, and eat. What if we were to take our home, our neighborhood, our life, give thanks, pass it out, and eat? What if we were to take our job and our money and our paycheck and our budget and give thanks, and pass it out, and eat? That, my friends, is the way of Jesus. This coming week, may you live from a heart posture, not of entitlement, but of gratitude. We need to relearn how to see and hear and remember and ask and give thanks. That's it. We need to relearn. I have no idea where you're at in life. No clue. Honestly, for me, this is God's word for my life right now. Last few months in my life have been hard and difficult. God's doing this amazing stuff in the life of our church, but it's not easy. You know, we're going on a decade now, and we started as a good, healthy, Jesus-centered, attractional megachurch, basically, in all honesty. And now we feel that God is calling us to step into being a good, healthy, Jesus-centered, more of a missionary church and a missionary movement of men and women who are empowered by the Spirit of Jesus to live that out in your life, in your calling, in your neighborhood, or whatever it is that God's stirring in your soul. There's a whole lot of people that wish we would go back to sermons and songs. We're not going to do it. I believe this is from Jesus. I believe it's his leading and his guiding. But man, has it been discouraging for me in recent weeks. And I feel like God keeps saying, Jean-Marc, you're like Israel in the wilderness. I honestly feel like God is testing our church right now. Like we're in a time of transition. I feel like we're in between Egypt and the promised land. We're on a journey. We're going from one place to another. I feel like God is testing our church. And I know, maybe I'm off on that, but I know that God is testing me. And the test is, Jean-Marc, will you trust me? Will you trust that I'm leading you? Will you trust that I'm guiding this church? Will you trust that I have a future and a hope for you? Will you trust that there's something better through the desert, through hardship? Will you trust that there's something better on the other side? Because if not, you're going to end up wandering in circles for a long, long time. So I know that for me, this is an invitation to trust. I have no idea where you're at. But to wrap up with these guys, it's interesting to me that this is a story about a meal. It's about food. And every time we share a meal with your family, with your friends, with your missional community, around a table, that food is a sign of Jesus' love and power and presence over your life. And the same is true for the meal that's right here in front of you, for the Lord's Supper. This is a sign. In fact, that word, give thanks, that phrase, is actually used twice in the text. Jesus gave thanks for the bread, and then Jesus gave thanks for the fish. That word is eucharistin in Greek, which is where we get the word. Anybody know? Eucharist, which is an ancient word meaning thanksgiving for the Lord's Supper. There's no doubt that Mark, the writer, is writing a few decades later in the life of the early church. There's no doubt that's a signpost pointing forward to the Lord's Supper, the Eucharist. That was the center of gravity in the life of the early church. Not the sermon, not music, not worship, none. That was all fantastic stuff, but the center of gravity was the bread and the cup. And every time we eat and drink, every time we break the bread open and we pour the cup out and we give thanks and we eat and we drink the body and the blood of Jesus, every time, this right here is a sign. This is evidence. This is proof of the miraculous and of the miraculous in the mundane. This is proof of Jesus' love for us, proof of Jesus' power over us, and proof of Jesus' presence with us. So right now, here's the plan. Go ahead and clear off your lap. As we step into a time of worship, rather than kind of step back and think and have quiet, right now we're going to open up the tables right here and right now. Get up out of your seat, come down, get the bread, get the cup, take it back to your seat, wait for a bit, and then in a minute we're all going to share this meal. It's really small, all right? It's really small. But we're all going to share this meal together and remember the sign of Jesus' presence. Go ahead, the tables are open.